gentlemen, there was when the after Solomon and the split came,
yes,
and Benjamin was with Judah, why did everybody else go north when really the worship should have been in the south?
There were economic incentives. Once the country split, they didn't want their funds going out of the country. So Samaria, the northern kingdom, Israel, was very interested in having people for Passover and so on and so forth to worship there within their country. And so you remember when the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4 said that you say that people ought to worship in Jerusalem, but our fathers worshipped on this mountain. And lo and behold, on the top of Mount Gerizim, there is the ruins of an ancient temple. There were a number of temples around. So a lot of it was economic. To have people have their loyalties down in Jerusalem and to go down there, spend a week, be buying food and putting money into the coffers down of the temple down there was not an attractive thing politically.
So then maybe I should ask, why did Benjamin go that way? You didn't know.
Well, Benjamin, the location of Benjamin includes Jerusalem. And so the issue there is where the leadership went and where the people went.
Okay.
And I suspect that a good portion of the populace ended up in Judah. So, it's kind of an interesting political type of thing that ended up happening. And the whole turmoil that happened as a result of that continues on into the New Testament.
Was Dan the capital city of Israel? Or did they have the temple in Israel?
Well, in the Northern Kingdom, the main temple that I'm aware of is in at Mount Gerizim, that is right near Sychar, which now is Nablus. If you look at a modern map of Israel, it's Nablus, which is a major Palestinian city. So it's
wouldn't six of the families have to spend their money in wherever the temple was? I mean, since there was a temple for the north, those other families and clans would have to spend money, if not in Judah, then they'd spend it wherever the capital was of the northern kingdom.
Capital or where the religious center was.
Right.
But it means money within their boundaries rather than money leaving the country.
So all the families merged into a northern kingdom, period, and they were all...
Yeah, ten tribes basically were part of the tax revolt that happened under Jeroboam the first.
Okay, yeah, that's where he said that they asked for mercy and he doubled the tax or something.
Right. So it's economics had a big part to play in the whole thing, and even when you look at David. For 7 years, David was king over the south and was not king over the north. There was a major rift between the northern parts of the country and the southern parts of the country, and that goes way back, even prior to there being a king to basically unify the country.
And that wasn't because they were taxed differently. There were different political issues at that.
Different political issues, and furthermore, the North has a very different topography. Let me illustrate that. When Napoleon conquered the area of Israel, and when he visited the area around Megiddo and Her Megiddo, which we know as what comes from that is Armageddon. Her means mountain. So the mountain of Megiddo, that's what Armageddon means. And so when Napoleon got to the Valley of Jezreel, there in the vicinity of Megiddo, and he looked out there, his pronouncement was, all the armies of the world could maneuver here.
Really?
So he said, this is a perfect place for a battle of epic proportions as described in the Bible about the battle. And actually, it's not a battle. It's a campaign. It's a series of battles. It's not just a single battle. Now, with the North having an area that's very easy for armies to traverse, what ended up happening was the Northern Kingdom was very easy for foreign powers to dominate. And so there was a difference in the way that the people approached things when there was a foreign power. And it's even easy to see that in New Testament times. In New Testament times, the Judeans did not think much of the Galileans, right? Well, one of the reasons was, they said, not only have they compromised and split off into the Northern Kingdom and had their own worship system, but there were all these foreign invaders, and they would come in. And because the North was so susceptible to being overrun by foreign powers, they would tend to say, what do we need to do to make you happy? What can we do to have you leave us alone and let us live peaceably? And they tended to buy into foreign religions. They tended to try to cooperate. The southern area, Judah, was far more difficult because of the topography. And as a result of that, they always looked at themselves as purists who didn't cave in. You may have heard of the Maccabean Revolt. Now, if you haven't heard of that, you've heard of Hanukkah. Well, Hanukkah, Feast of Lights or Dedication, happened because the Maccabeans won independence from the Syrian Greeks. But the Syrian Greeks, under a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, that the Jews, the Judeans nicknamed, and instead of saying Epiphanes, manifestation of, they said Epimanes. So they said that his name meant madman. And so they would make fun of his name and so forth. But what ended up happening was this particular Greek ruler of Greek Syria was told that the way that he could make the Judeans come into subjection over him was for him to prove that his gods were superior to theirs. And how would he do that? He went into the temple and offered a sow on the altar. He did it through a priest. And Judas Maccabeus killed that priest on the spot. And then led a rebellion. And they had very interesting guerrilla tactics. They would go against the Syrian Greek army at all of the mountain passes. And they were just making life very difficult for the Syrian Greeks. And as a result, the Syrian Greeks ultimately lost control. And 1 year to the day after the sow was sacrificed on the altar at the temple in Jerusalem, they had the feast of dedication, Hanukkah. And that's the reason that Hanukkah is observed by Jews. And Jesus observed Hanukkah in John chapter 10. But essentially, the southern tribes looked, and they always said, we are pure. We haven't been contaminated. We never have caved in. And the assessment, when you look at Stephen's sermon in Acts 6 and 7, he goes through it, he's talking about the history of Israel, and the people are listening, and they're saying, okay, yeah, this is right, this is right, this is right, this is right. And then he finally got to the end of it, and he said, you're just like your forefathers, always resisting the Holy Spirit. Which of the prophets did your fathers not kill? So when he got to the punchline, then they stoned him to death. They could hear the history, and they couldn't see that their history was one of constantly rebelling against God. But they thought, we are so pure. And they looked down their nose at the Gentiles. They had looked down their nose at the Samaritans. They looked down their nose at the Galileans. And God said that they were awful themselves. But the topography is different enough between the north and the south that it tended to have the two areas of the country often thinking that they had a different set of interests. You know, it's like here in Colorado, people up in the mountains and the West Slope don't look at things the same way as people in Denver. And the people out on the plains don't look at things the same way as the ones in Denver. But there are so many people in Denver that guess who sets the tone for everybody else? And that's the type of thing that created rivalries between the north and the south. They were very different areas. And you know, you look at Israel and you say, that's a pretty small place. But because they didn't have their eyes on the Lord, they kept splitting apart. And geography plays a role in that. Their history, the history of the two parts of the country is just absolutely fascinating. Okay, well, this message for tonight is by request. Steve wanted me to talk about Romans 8 because there apparently is a series that's probably on its way there at church.
At Red Rocks, yeah.
At Red Rocks.
Challenged us to read it each day, Romans 8 this week.
I suspect that what I'm going to say probably is going to be a little different than what you'll hear. I just would kind of imagine that. But that's all right. Let me say why it is that I have a full paper here rather than just having notes. This is going to be a paper that I will be presenting up in Wyoming. It is a revision, as if you look at the first footnote, of a paper that I presented on April 22nd, 2014 at GES. So I start out with a manuscript, and then I reduce it down to notes. So right now it's still in the manuscript stage. For the conference, I'll be shortening it to a series of outline notes, but work from a manuscript first. And so one of the things that I need to do in this paper when I present it is to talk about my mentor, Zane Hodges. Zane Hodges had a great deal of influence upon the Grace Evangelical Society and was a major reason that a number of us are standing for a consistent grace message. He died in 2008, but 3 years earlier he had started a commentary on Romans. And the reason that he had started that commentary was that he was convinced that the book of Romans, although it is greatly loved by Christianity, is widely misunderstood. And one of the things that he said is that Romans chapter 8 is the most misunderstood chapter in the whole book. So I'd like to trace a little bit of history as to why it is that Zane Hodges came to see the book of Romans in a different way than his professors even had seen it. So I say here, Zane Hodges indicated that his own understanding of the book of Romans aligned with that of his seminary professors until he started wrestling with Romans chapter 5, verses 9 and 10. Why don't we turn there? That passage he simply could not reconcile with the way that Romans is normally taught. When someone says salvation, when a preacher says salvation, what do they usually mean?
From the lake of fire.
From the lake of fire, by believing in Jesus Christ, right? Okay, well, let's look at Romans 5, verses 9 and 10, and let's see if that will work in this book. Much more than having been justified by his blood. Now, we regularly hear justification equated with salvation that leads to a person not going to the lake of fire, right? And that, in this case, would be correct because of the context. Much more than having been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him. Now, is the justification here past, present, or future?
Past.
Past. And is the salvation past, present, or future?
Past.
Salvation?
Future.
No.
Future.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm justified.
Now, there's no place anywhere that we can find evidence that will allow equating wrath with the lake of fire or hell. Wrath is in time. The lake of fire will be God's justice, not his wrath. But now there's something even bigger here in this verse. Much more. If I were to say that woman is tender with the children that she is babysitting, much more with her own children. Notice that saying, she's this way and is very noble, very good with this group of children. But with her own, there's a special relationship, and there's even a higher quality in terms of her dealings with her own children than the ones that she's babysitting. much more says that two things are different. He's saying, if we've been justified in the past, much more, he's going to do something that he hasn't yet done. Well, we can't say that salvation here equals justification, can we? There's no way. And in case we didn't catch that, look at verse 10. For if, when we were enemies, we were reconciled. Is the reconciliation past, present, or future?
Yes.
Past. We were reconciled to God through the death of his Son. Much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. His death produced reconciliation. It made peace between us and God. But he isn't saying his death on the cross is what will save us. It's his life. Now, have you ever heard anyone say that by Jesus' life he paid for everyone's sins? If they said that, they're wrong. He paid for sins. He paid the death penalty of sin by his death. But his life, the fact that he was resurrected and he lives in resurrection power, Paul says that that has a role in bringing about a deliverance for us in the future. Now, do you see why Zane looked at this passage and said, all my professors have been talking about salvation and justification and reconciliation as though they were all the same thing in this book? So that made it so that as he was reading the book, he would have to say, I think this book is saying something a little different than the way everyone's contorting it. They're trying to fit it into their theological systems, and they're not really listening to the book. So Zane's discovery of this, back in the 1960s, caused him to keep looking at and keep looking at and keep examining the book of Romans. And as a result of just spending years studying his Greek text, reading it, analyzing it, saying, what is Paul saying in this whole book? And remember, my principle is you have to understand whole books. These two verses told Zane that the normal understanding of Romans is not right because people make equations between things that should not be equated. So he kept studying the book of Romans. Now, there's an implication of this second paragraph that should be obvious, but we may overlook. God did not unfold the book of Romans to Zane Hodges all at once. Some things that Hodges said in 1981 or 1985 differ from what he said in 2005 to 2008 while he was researching and writing his commentary on Romans. He spent two whole years devoted to research in which he didn't write anything except notes. And it wasn't until 2007 that he started writing the commentary. He just read. He read everything he could get a hold of. He'd study his Greek text, and he would read what all of the scholars were saying on the book of Romans. And he kept wrestling with it. So he would see things, oh, hadn't thought of this way. How does that work out? And then test it through the book. And after he had spent 2 years that way, then he started writing. in 2007. He died in November of 2008. Well, let's look at some of his earlier statements about Romans chapter 8, verses 29 and 30. I'd like for us to look at that verse. That's what we're going to be emphasizing. This passage is often called the golden chain. And the logic of it is, everybody who's called, or everybody who's predestined, is called, and so on and so forth. So, to whom he, or who, for whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. Nobody drops out. That he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he predestined, these he also called. Whom he called, these he also justified. And whom he justified, these he also glorified. And this passage is often seen to prove eternal security. Now, we absolutely believe in eternal security. But ultimately, Zane came to believe that this passage has nothing to do with eternal security. And when we look at this passage, and when it's preached, people say, way, 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 way back in eternity past, God predestined certain people so that they would get eternal life. And you know, the whole picture is presented as though it's talking about someone coming to believe and then ending up in heaven. That's the way this passage is normally taught. Well, lo and behold, in 1981 and 1985, that is how Zane Hodges understood it. But because he kept studying and kept studying and kept studying, he came to the conclusion that what he had thought for many years wasn't exactly what Paul was aiming at. Let's see what he said in 1981. Everyone who has ever accepted God's gracious salvation will one day be conformed to the image of his Son, Romans 8:29, and will enter the eternal world totally free from the least trace of sin. No doubt not all of them will have attained to co-heirship. We'll talk about that a little later, with Jesus Christ. But all will be among history's immortals. So, he thought this was talking about all Christians. And it was guaranteeing that all Christians will be conformed to Christ's image in the sense that they'll all be purified. They'll be before him in a sinless state. That's the normal view. Well, let's see what he said in 1985. Of course, this immortality consists in a sinless and glorious likeness to Christ. Thus, Paul declared, for whom he foreknew, he predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he predestined, these he also called. Whom he called, these he also justified. And whom he justified, these he also glorified. And he said, these are impressive words, and as often stated, there is no break in this chain. Those who are predestined to conformity to Christ are not only called and justified, but ultimately glorified as well. This is the child of God's inalienable inheritance. He said, this proves eternal security. That's the standard view. Well, since I was called upon to help to create notes for the commentary, because Zane died having only reached chapter 14 of Romans, and he hadn't written any of the technical notes and hadn't written the introduction, I was invited to contribute some. So I did. As part of that, I read through his commentary. And when I got to this section talking about Romans 8, I said, whoa, I never looked at this the way that Zayn is seeing this. So, in his commentary, Zayn was starting to see things differently. I say starting to because the commentary, his commentary on 8, 29, and 30 seems to reflect transition of thought, not a settled conclusion. The passage discusses joint heirs with Christ, not heirs of God. Romans 8, 17 speaks of all believers as heirs of God. Let's go to Romans 8, 17. We'll be talking about that verse. He says, Paul says, that if people are children of God, then they are heirs. They receive an inheritance. Heirs of God. And joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. The way that this is set up is it's saying all believers are heirs of God. But those believers who suffer with Christ, when Paul is talking about people suffering with Christ, he's saying those that take a stand for Christ, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in our family, with our friends, or we're sharing the gospel even with people that we don't even know, we get some suffering. Here in this country, it's tended to be down to the level of ridicule. But now we've got guys that will pull out swords and they're wanting to slice up people just because they happen to be at a Wednesday Bible study. We've got a lot of things going on that are just absolutely wild. Kind of looks like a return to the first century. But actually, outside of the United States, been kind of normal conditions. Persecution for standing up for Christ has been the rule of things all over the world. And what Paul is saying is people who suffer with Christ because they are taking a stand for him receive something special. They're not just believers. They're not just heirs of God. But they're co-heirs with Christ. And so, as I say, Zayn started to see this passage a little differently, but as one looks at his commentary, which I intended to bring, but I left at home, it seems as though he was somewhere between seeing new thoughts and was also writing about old thoughts. And so he was kind of in transition. Say something about how Zayn wrote. He would write an entire book, first draft. And then he would do a second draft. And then he would sit down and write notes. He didn't want to get involved in the technicalities. He wanted to focus on making his words clear. And you've read Zayn. He can say things so clearly in so few words, and you say, wow. But on this particular occasion, what happened? He died before anyone else saw his words. And no one was able to ask him, you say this, and you say this. How do these connect? And Zayn would have either said, have you thought about this? That was one of his favorite questions, and you'd say, no, actually I hadn't. Or sometimes he'd say, you've got a point. The fact of the matter is, we can't ask Zayn what he meant. He seems to have been in the process of transition, but hadn't reached necessarily a full conclusion. Now, I need to define a little bit about this co-heirship, because, you know, we're not talking about Zeppelins going around. Co-heirship is co-inheritance. And that we need to have an understanding of. So we're going to look at Old Testament inheritance. Assume that a father has three sons as heirs, and we're looking in the Old Testament. How do we calculate the proportioning of the estate? Well, there are three heirs. So what you do is you count up the number of portions as the number of heirs plus one. So that's going to be four. And the one who is designated as the firstborn, who was not necessarily the first one of them who was born. So remember, Jacob became firstborn, but Esau was born before him. Firstborn means the one who gets the firstborn double portion. So if you have... Yes, Diane?
Why? Why did they get the double portion?
I can't answer that for sure from the Old Testament, but my suspicion is that it was looking forward to allowing Jesus to have a special inheritance. So I think God was looking forward to what he wanted to do with Jesus Christ and with New Testament believers under the co-inheritance. So I can't answer from the Old Testament, but I think that God was anticipating what he wanted to do and set up a pattern in the Old Testament. So that's as close... And so, if there were three sons, then take three plus one, you get four parts, and the one who's designated as firstborn gets the double portion.
And the daughters just weren't part of the inheritance?
It wasn't normally the part of the inheritance, although there were provisions where exceptions were made. My sense there, once again, is it's in anticipation of what God was planning to do in the New Testament, that he was aiming at, okay, this is what needs to be in place. I don't have an explanation other than that as to why it happened the way it did. And it'll be a question that I may be asking God, okay, can you tell me about this? I'm sure I'll say, oh, I never thought about that. It'll remind me of Zane's questions. So let's think about Jacob and his sons. Remember, he had 12 sons and one daughter who was in the kitchen with Dinah.
Oh, that's right.
And so we add one part to the 12, and that makes 13. Well, how did it work with Jacob? Well, in Genesis 49, God blessed 11 sons equally. How did he bless the one receiving the firstborn portion? That is Joseph. He is mentioned in 49, but he really gets his inheritance through verse or chapter 48. Joseph was the elder son of the favored wife, Rachel. You may remember how Laban tricked Jacob. Probably Jacob had a little too much wine. It was dark, and he didn't recognize Leah versus Rachel and so on and so forth. So he found himself with two wives. But his favored wife was always Rachel, who never seemed to be able to bear a child. And finally, after many years, she bore Joseph. So Joseph is the first offspring of the favored wife, the one that he intended to marry. And how Jacob ended up giving the double portion to Joseph was Joseph had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And so Manasseh and Ephraim were Jacob's grandsons. But in chapter 48 of Genesis, he adopted them as if they were his own sons. Yes, Ty?
Why? Why didn't he just give it to Joseph?
Well, it made it so that there were essentially the equivalent of two extra tribes. And so it made it very clear, it was unerasable, that there was a second portion that was given to Joseph, because both Manasseh and Ephraim could trace their lineage back through Joseph. Now, I say here in the notes above the chart, Ephraim means doubly fruitful. The ayim ending means double. So in Hebrew, you have a singular, you have a dual, and you have a plural. So you can say horse, sus. Then you can say a pair of horses, susain. And you can say horses, more than two, susot. And the ayim ending is a dual. We only have singular and plural. They had singular, dual, and plural. And so the name means doubly fruitful. And so, interestingly enough, Joseph named him that without realizing that he was going to be the one who is going to receive the double portion. So what happens? If you look at my chart, Joseph's column is twice as wide as everyone else's. And then Ephraim's column is twice as wide as Manasseh's. So when we look at co-inheritance with Jesus, that you may have overlooked one word that showed up in 8:29. Let's look at Romans 8:29. For whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn. Jesus gets a double portion because he is the unique inheritor son. We are children of God. But Jesus is the unique son, the one who is the firstborn, the one with the special inheritance rights. So now let's look at Romans 8:17 again. And if we're children of God, just by believing in Jesus Christ, we are heirs, heirs of God. So we're children of God, and we get our portion, a single portion. But what happens if a person suffers with Christ? Because they take a stand for him and suffer consequences as a result. They suffer ridicule, and they suffer even in other ways. They become co-heirs with Christ. But Christ is the firstborn with a double portion. Do you see how Paul is communicating that believers, because they believed, are guaranteed a certain inheritance? But believers who are vocal about their faith, despite the fact that they may be ridiculed and not everybody likes being told about Jesus, that those who put Jesus' interest first are ones that receive co-heirship with the firstborn inheritor. Now that puts a very much different spin on this passage than is normally presented. And there are scholars who have recognized that there is a special inheritance spoken of in 8:17. Grace Evangelical Society, in large part because of how much emphasis Zane Hodges gave to the concept of co-heirship, has been dedicated to this. But Zane's understanding of the book kept growing as he kept studying. And so now let's move into that underneath the chart. Thus Joseph, through Ephraim and Manasseh, received a double portion, while Ephraim received a double portion within Joseph's inheritance. Note that Joseph's column is twice as wide as any other brother's. Note that Ephraim's is twice the width of Manasseh. Consider now Romans 8:17. And this is Zane's translation. And if we are children, we are also heirs. Heirs on the one hand of God, and on the other hand, co-heirs with Christ, if we suffer together with him, so we may also be glorified together with him. Romans 8:29 identifies Jesus as the firstborn inheritor. He will have a far greater kingdom inheritance than ordinary children of God. However, Romans 8:17 speaks of those believers who suffer with him as co-heirs with Christ, the firstborn, not just as ordinary heirs. With Romans 8:17 and Old Testament inheritance rules as background, let us consider what Zane Hodges wrote about Romans 8:29 in the commentary. And he's not talking about people becoming believers. He's not talking about people becoming heirs by believing in Jesus Christ. He's talking about the people who suffer with Christ and become co-heirs. He says, our destiny that God has predetermined for us is to share the likeness of his firstborn heir, that is Jesus Christ. But as we noted under verse 17, in the Old Testament, the firstborn son inherited twice as much as the rest of the sons. Since all the children of God are heirs of God, see verse 17, they have an heirship as a facet of this future likeness. But as verse 17 also declares, co-heirship is also a possibility, since if we co-suffer with him, we shall also be co-glorified with him. See discussion under verse 17. He continues. In Romans 8, to share the likeness of his son is not simply to be morally and spiritually like him. Marvelous beyond words though that is. But in this passage, 8:17 to 30, the preeminent emphasis lies in our sharing his destiny as the heir of all things. This was a major change from what he wrote in 1981 and 1985. In 1981 and 1985, he said, to be conformed to the image of his son is we're going to be sinless in his presence. But now he says, much more than that. It is looking at inheriting not just what ordinary believers inherit, but receiving a portion of Christ's double portion as the inheritor of all things. So he changed his mind here, and yet when you look at the context in his commentary, you end up saying, well, how do you reconcile that with this, and how do you reconcile that with the other thing? Because it seems like he was in between his old position and starting to see a new one. And the unfortunate thing is, he died before any editing could happen, so we couldn't ask him about it. So we're having to guess. Well, I believe that Zane Hodges was pointing in the right direction. I assume that he penned these last words in 2007, but he died in 2008. No one, not even the editor of his Romans commentary, saw those words until after he died. Yet other portions of his commentary on 8:29 and 30 reflect his older view. This suggests that his views were shifting. I am sure that he expected that the back and forth editorial process, which he expected to occur in his lifetime, would help him refine his thought. That was not to be. I have viewed his manuscript as a challenge from Hodges to his close associates. saying, see where this leads. Well, three possibilities must be considered. The first one is that Romans 8, 29 and 30 discusses all believers, as almost everyone thinks. The second possibility is that Zane understood things a little better than we, as some of his students, understand his own words. And if we had asked him, he might have been able to say, well, have you considered this? And we'd say, oh, I get it. But then the third possibility is that he hadn't fully reached where this was all pointing. That it's only talking about what is guaranteed to the co-heirs. That is the position that I take, and I'm going to give a couple of really quick reasons for holding that. Note that both views 1 and 3 deal well with the language of guarantee. I mean, when he says, those that he predestined, he also called, and those whom he called, I mean, you look at that and you say, every single one, no dropouts. That's language of guarantee. Views 1 and 3 deal well with guarantee, but view 2 doesn't seem to. Where he was on that in these two verses seems to create a little bit of tension on that point. And I don't quite know how to reconcile it. Maybe Zane did. Maybe he had it. But his words haven't given some of us who have investigated enough clues to see how that would be the case. So now how do I decide between 1 and 3? 1 is the old view that everybody holds. And 3 is a new view. Well, the whole chapter, the entirety of Romans 8, urges believers who are heirs of God to become co-heirs with Christ. Thus, I see view 3 as continuing the contextual flow. And the rest of this paper will present a contextual argument in favor of view 3. Gospel Under Siege, which is a book that Zane wrote, and Grace and Eclipse, another book that he wrote, clarified the significance of co-heirship in Romans 8:17, and to emphasize its impact upon the chapter as a whole. Hodges' translation follows, and if we are children, this is 8:17, we are also heirs. Heirs on the one hand of God, and on the other hand, co-heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer together with him, so we may be glorified together with him. The concept is that all believers as children of God are heirs of God, but only those who suffer with Christ become his co-heirs. Romans 8:29 calls Jesus the firstborn. His inheritance far exceeds that of other children of God. Being a co-heir with the firstborn is a privilege that greatly exceeds merely being called God's child. Hodges, in his Romans commentary, comments further. The second heirship, co-heirship with Christ, is predicated on co-suffering that leads to co-glorification. The word if, in Greek it's aper, indicates the conditional nature of the statement. It is false grammar to say that the if clause treats this as a definite fact. It doesn't assume that all Christians suffer with him. Only some do. The construction means no more than the expression on the assumption that someone suffers with him, and leaves open, fully open, the opposite possibility. It is this last aspect of our heirship that leads Paul directly into the theme of suffering, which will occupy him until the end of the chapter. Now, actually, I believe that suffering pervades the whole chapter. Let me explain. Let's look at the beginning of the chapter. I mean, Zane is right. There's a special kind of suffering It's in the last half. But you know, when people read walking according to the flesh, they tend to think of someone sinning it up, right? And walking according to the flesh, you say, you know, you're supposed to walk according to the Spirit. Don't walk according to the flesh. And everybody's thinking of someone going out and, you know, trying to sin it up. I mean, just living the most licentious lifestyle they could possibly live. Not in this context at all. I'm going to read Romans 8:1, and there are going to be words that might not be in your Bible. If you don't have a New King James, there are going to be words that are going to be missing that belong there. There is therefore now no condemnation. Well, condemnation is a terrible translation. There is now therefore no penal servitude. Penal is penalty, you know, like a penal colony is penalty. God imposed a penalty on all of mankind as a result of the sin in the garden. Remember thorns and thistles and the whole thing. That's making it so that life has a certain level of futility. God brought into mankind's life futility. When we read Genesis 3, we don't see God pronouncing them dead, do we? But he announced in Genesis 2:17, the very day you eat of it, dying, you will die. But what did God pronounce? God pronounced a penal servitude. He pronounced a penalty. He said, from now on, by the sweat of your brow, you're going to work, and things aren't going to come easily like they did in the garden. There is therefore now no penal servitude to those who are in Christ Jesus, who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. He's saying, one does not escape penal servitude just by believing in Christ. One escapes penal servitude by being a believer who doesn't walk by the flesh, but instead walks according to the Spirit. Now, I've made the statement that it is not talking about sinning it up. Why? Romans chapter 7. In Romans 7, Paul talked about his experience as a believer when he tried to please God by trying to keep the law. That didn't work. That's a fleshly attempt at trying to please God, trying to live according to the law, trying to live according to rules. And in this chapter, he's saying, don't try to please God by rule keeping. Don't try the experiment that I had done. If we think, I've got to go to church on Sunday because God will get me if I don't. I've got to give 10%. I've got to read my Bible so many hours a day. I've got to wear holes in my pants because I'm praying on my knees. I've got to, and we set up rules and rules and rules and rules. And we don't find the rules that we are making up. We don't please God by keeping a list of rules. Yesterday, Diane and I were married 37 years.
Congratulations.
Now, how happy would Diane be if I said, you know, I've got a list and I make sure I do this and I do this and I do this and I do this. Okay, I've done everything that I have to do for you, so okay, great. What does God think when we approach him? I've got my list and I've got to do my things. That's not how we approach it when we have a love relationship. And in Romans, he is urging believers to live by the Spirit rather than by a set of rules. Oh, see, I've done these things. God's happy with me. That's not how it works. And the whole section here, people either suffer because they're under penal servitude. Because when you work, and the car breaks down, and this doesn't work, and people are late in doing what they were supposed to. You know, the thorns and thistles, nothing works out quite like it was supposed to. We suffer with that, right? And Paul says that suffering that we have that is part of the curse that is still in place, not just, I mean, believing didn't end it, and trying to please God by the law didn't do it. But if instead we are walking by the Spirit, he's no longer viewing what we face in life as suffering that we deserve to have because we are law keepers. If indeed the suffering that we have is because we're aiming at pleasing God and we suffer in that regard, he says that leads to co-heirship. But look at what else he says. Look at verse 18. For I consider that the sufferings of the present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. Do note that word glory. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly awaits the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility back at the fall, there in the garden. Not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. When God put the world under penal servitude, he did so with the promise that he would one day end it. That's what we're looking forward to with the millennium. And what Paul is saying is, we suffer right now in a cursed earth that is under a curse, that is under penal servitude, but we can rise above God viewing the suffering that we face as penal servitude, penalty, because we deserve it, into something that we suffer because we're suffering for Christ. And that's rewardable. Making it so that in the life to come, we can have co-heirship with Christ.
So the works part of living by the Spirit is not for eternal life, obviously. It's
right.
For rewards.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It's like that pastor is in Iran that he's supposed to say he's not a Christian.
Yeah, and he's imprisoned and facing all sorts of stuff, and he refuses to cave in.
Mm-hmm. And he keeps getting beaten up.
Yeah. That's rewardable. And so, you know, we look at our life and we often think, poor me, why me? And God looks at it, if what we're doing is in service to him, and we suffer because of that, it is rewardable. And Paul is encouraging the people there towards co-heirship. Everyone's going to suffer. But the question is, do we suffer because we're part of a cursed earth, or do we suffer in the service of Christ that leads to reward? And Paul is giving a whole different approach for us as we face life.
This is really interesting, John, because we're Tuesday nights doing Ecclesiastes. And Solomon has everything, but he's suffering.
Yes.
Because he's under penal servitude.
Absolutely.
Everybody that's here, you can't escape it.
Right.
So what Paul's saying here is, why not suffer for something rewardable
right.
than for the vanity or hevel of this earth?
Yes. Absolutely.
That makes good sense.
Mm-hmm. So, let's see. Let's go ahead with my last paragraph on page 3. The concluding statement is significant. Let us test it. Romans 8:18 urges the readers to regard present sufferings as a mere pittance compared to the glories yet to be revealed. All creation is groaning, suffering, because it has been temporarily subjected to futility in the anticipation of release from bondage. Not only creation, but those with the first fruits of the Spirit eagerly await redemption of the body. 8:22 and 23. We have been delivered in hope, for which we should wait with endurance. 8:24 to 25. The Holy Spirit intercedes for suffering believers who pray, which Romans 10 refers to as calling upon the Lord that leads to deliverance. All things work together toward the good, and people misunderstand this passage, and they'll quote it glibly in all sorts of ways, and they don't understand what it's saying in its context. Do we want to live in this suffering situation for all eternity?
No.
Wouldn't that be awful? Wouldn't we want to be in the Lord's presence in the millennial kingdom with the curse removed from the earth and able to be there in his presence without sin entangling us? And wouldn't that be wonderful? Isn't that really what we're looking for? And what Paul is saying in Romans 8:28 is, we know that all things work together for the good, for the millennium. God has promised it. He's going to bring it about. And all the things that are going on in this crazy earth are not going to stop God from doing what he has promised. The good that he's talking about in this context is he's going to bring about his plan, which includes the millennium, which includes removal of the curse from this earth. It works out together for good for whom? For those who love God. Is that a description of all Christians? No, it is not. Christians who are trying to please God by living according to rules, who are living according to the flesh, are not expressing love for God. They are in rebellion. It is the believers who are walking by the Spirit that, as a result, are suffering with Christ instead of under penal servitude that are the ones that Paul would say love God. And for those that are called according to his purpose, what he is saying here is God is going to bring about the millennium for the benefit of the co-heirs. Everybody else is going to benefit. All other believers are going to benefit. But God is working out the good, especially for the benefit of those that he has made promises that walking by the Spirit into suffering with Christ leads to co-glorification in the millennial kingdom. And he's saying, God has not forgotten us. Here we are in this cursed earth, and God plans to keep what he has promised. It is aiming preeminently at God is in charge of history, and he's working it towards bringing about the millennium where he's going to straighten all things out within the context. Now, in light of that, would it really make sense for Romans 8, 29, and 30 to talk about that which is true for all believers? Or does it make more sense for Paul to be continuing to look at the promises that God makes to those who are faithful to him? I think Zane was starting to get an inkling of the right idea. he was the one that gave some of us a hint, and then we've been exploring that hint. Let's see, look at the first full paragraph on page 5. The focus throughout Romans 8 is co-heirship. The book addresses believers, heirs of God. In the first section of Romans 8, Paul urges believers to walk by the Spirit. The aim in doing so is that they might become co-heirs of Christ through suffering with Christ, that they might be co-glorified with him. In all of this, they are no longer under the futility of penal servitude, 8:1. Ultimately, they will be more than conquerors. They will be co-heirs whose exposure to suffering did not separate them from loving Christ. Remember we talked in 8:28, those who love God. The love of God here is our love for God. So the inference, what shall we say then? Romans 8:17-28 and 31-39 focus on co-heirs suffering with Christ that they might be more than conquerors. Romans 8:1-16 emphasizes walking by the Spirit, so we may no longer be under penal servitude, so we might become co-heirs. But what about the other two verses of the chapter, 8:29 and 30? Well, if Romans 8:1-28 and 31-39 focus on co-heirship with the firstborn rather than general heirship as children, well then why would interpreters look at 8:29 following, at 8:29 and 30, as focusing on the general heirship, becoming God's children through faith alone in our crucified and resurrected Savior alone? That doesn't seem to fit the context. The context would seem to be aiming at co-heirship. On page 2 of this paper, especially note 6, a small percentage of expositors and theologians recognize that Romans 8:17 discusses two inheritance. It is not the only passage discussing this concept. However, if the vast majority of interpreters fail to see two heirships in 8:17, why would anyone expect them to see it elsewhere in Romans 8? Of course they wouldn't. In light of this sad track record, how many theologians or exegetes have even considered the possibility that Romans 8:29 and 30 might discuss the golden chain of the co-heirs? Zane Hodges was exploring virgin territory. He was seeing glimpses of this pair of verses pointing to co-heirship, but was not yet ready to let go of the old model, that it was the golden chain of the heirs. His comments are a both-and proposal. With regard to being conformed to Christ's everlasting life and sinlessness that is guaranteed by the golden chain, with regard to being conformed to him as preeminent heir, the golden chain makes that potential. And it's going in two different directions. I wonder what he would have said if asked, how can the golden chain portray both guarantee and potentiality? I also wonder what he might have said if asked, if the focus of 8:29 and following is co-heirship, how can it also be about general heirship? Another question would be if 8:1-28 and 31-39 look at co-heirship, how can 8:29-30 be about general heirship at all? I suspect he would have said, you men have a point. That would have been a most gracious response as usual. Now, since we cannot ask this of Zane, we must ask and look for the answer ourselves. Let us start with Zane Hodges' translation of 8:29-30. Because of those he knew in advance, he also predestined to share the likeness of his son so that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And whom he predetermined, these he also called, and whom he called, these he also justified, and whom he justified, these he also glorified. Let us remind ourselves of a point mentioned on page 4 of this paper. I've only touched on it briefly. Hodges rightly sees Romans 8:31-39 as discussing a topic other than eternal security. Let's go there. Let's start at 8:31 and following. When this is taught, it is normally taught as you're guaranteed everlasting life, it can't be taken away from you. Well, that's a truth. Everlasting life cannot be taken away from us. But this passage is not talking about that. It's talking about nothing can force a believer to cease loving God by walking according to the Spirit and being willing to suffer for Him. If we are doing that, if we're pleasing to Him in the way that would lead to co-heirship, if we abandon that, we're not able to say that anything forced us to do it. We chose to. He is seeking to assure people who are seeking to be pleasing to God that they don't have to be scared to death of, well, what if something really tough comes along? Will I cave in? Will I cease loving the Lord? Will I cease serving Him? He's saying, if we're walking by the Spirit, there is nothing that can force us. There are things that might entice us, but there's nothing that can force us to turn our back on the Lord and return to walking by according to the flesh. There's nothing that can force it. So let's look at it from that perspective. 8:31. What shall we say then to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Well, all those people are persecuting me. But they're nobodies. All they can issue is suffering in this day. But God richly rewards suffering for Him, making those who do so co-heirs so that they can be co-glorified. Verse 32, He who did not spare His own Son but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him also freely give us all things? Of course He will sustain us. Verse 33, Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. God is not in the business of bringing charges. God is wanting to support those who are seeking to be pleasing to Him. Who is He who condemns? It is Christ who died and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who makes intercession for us. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? He said, none of these things, none of these kinds of sufferings have the power to force us to turn our back on the Lord. And we see believers who stand up to persecution and we're just amazed. But God gives strength in those times. And that's what He's talking about. As it is written, for your sake we are killed all the day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. Do you see how Paul is talking about suffering with Christ? And he's saying that's rewardable. And he's saying the suffering can't force us to lose out. God is faithful to believers who are faithful to Him. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through Him who loved us. Well, why are we more than conquerors? It's because He sustains, and look at the promises that He makes. And among those promises, all things work together for the good, that is the millennium, which He has designed to produce good for those that love Him, to those who are called according to His purpose. For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, that's pretty serious suffering, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, those are pretty powerful sources of persecution, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of Christ, from loving Christ, which is Christ Jesus our Lord. He is here aiming at, it is worth it to suffer for Him. I cannot see Romans 8, 29, and 30 in any way other than he is sustaining those that are suffering with Christ because they are walking by the Spirit and they love Christ, even suffering persecution. So, taking Romans 8, 29 to 30 in the sense of the golden chain for the co-heirs, it would mean, and this is sort of an expanded paraphrase, God knew in advance which believers would be co-inheritors with Christ. He prepared a destiny beforehand that they would share the likeness of his Son that goes beyond being morally and spiritually like him. It extends to them sharing his destiny as heir of all things, the firstborn. Those with this destiny being prepared beforehand, he invited or called. Of course, the invitation was extended to all Christians, but he certainly invited the ones that responded appropriately. These same ones were vindicated, that is, justified, at the Bema seat with, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Then those who are vindicated will be glorified. Glory is picking up on 8:17 to 21. The glorification in 8:30 is the co-glorification of the co-heirs in context. In light of that, Romans 8:31 to 39 reminds believers whose love for Christ that results from walking by the Spirit, that love which causes them to suffer with Christ, is something of value. The suffering with Christ that they suffer is nothing in comparison with co-glorification. He reminds them that nothing external can cause them to abandon their love for Christ that comes from walking by the Spirit. The believer who walks by the Spirit can look forward to co-heirship. In conclusion, what a travesty it is that Christendom has focused on the wrong heirship in Romans 8. They're looking at the heirship that comes because a person is believed. And then they say, well, if you're sinning it up, if you have too much sin in your life, you must not have really been a Christian. And it goes in all sorts of directions that are totally contrary to what Paul is arguing. They would say, oh, if you're not walking by the Spirit, you're an unbeliever. But then how do they try to walk by the Spirit? By walking according to the law. And they say walking according to the law is not walking according to the flesh because they think walking according to the flesh is sinning it up. And they don't look at walking according to the law as walking according to the flesh. They tend to become law keepers as attempts to prove that they walk by the Spirit. As such, they live the Romans 7 life and do not realize that what they do is exactly what Paul said not to do. Needless to say, this is probably a little different exposition of the chapter than you've normally heard. But since it's in a kind of a rough draft manuscript form, you can look over it. Spend time with Romans 8. Yes, Diane?
I think what comes out when you were talking about the firstborn, you know, with Joseph's son, that believers that walk in the Spirit or suffer actually get the first portion.
Yes.
That's how I can equate it.
That's exactly right. And now to answer your question that you asked earlier.
Which one?
You asked about why it was that God had set up the firstborn the way he did.
Yeah, okay.
And I said that my best answer, because I didn't have an answer from the Old Testament, is that God wanted to show what he wanted to do with believers. So it's, we sometimes puzzle over passages and say, I don't know why. But when we start finding out what whole books mean and then which passages really line up with which other passages, all sorts of things start opening up. And, oh, maybe that's what he had in mind. So, Six Secrets, this is very much in keeping with what we were talking about in terms of that book. Because the concept of walking by the Spirit is the focal point of how God wants believers to live. And as a result of walking by the Spirit, we're going to find ourselves handing out living waters, talking with people, and sometimes we're going to experience rejection, and various things are going to happen, and people make fun of us or get written up on Facebook or all sorts of things. And God is looking at people who are willing to take a stand for Him. And He says, I don't forget that. I don't forget that. And Romans 8 is generally not understood this way. The main place where I see Zane Hodges changing his view was within these two verses, 8:29 and 30. Every other piece he really seemed to have in place a long, long, long time ago. But then he started exploring, and I certainly would have loved to have been able to ask him, okay, Zane, help me out. I'm kind of lost here a little bit in what you're saying, because I'm seeing one thing and I'm seeing another thing. I don't quite know how to put them together. And some of us who are close students of his have been wrestling over this ever since 2009, saying, how do we put this together? And I had reached conclusions in 2014, but I didn't state them openly at the conference. What I did was to say, we need to explore this a little further. And so I gave it a little bit of time, and now I'm saying where I think it goes.
So is your understanding of chapter 8 similar to Zane's, in that you've transitioned from your professors to your current understanding?
Right. Well, Zane was one of my professors, although I did not have him for Romans. That would have been an eye-opening experience, because my understanding of things at the time that I was in Romans, it was one of our Greek classes, so we translated the whole book and diagrammed a lot of it and so on and so forth, but my understanding wasn't like it became afterwards. Started spending a lot of time with Zane and looking at a lot of things that he said and wrote, and he had this way of, you'd be talking with him and you'd ask him a question and he'd say, have you ever thought of this? It was like, no, I think I'm going back to the drawing board.
So is this the start of this theory of chapter 8, or are there other Bibles, scholars that are on this track too, or is this kind of something you're...
We are a relatively small group. But a lot of the things have been in place for a number of years. When Zane wrote in 1981, if a person were to put together how he handled each passage in Romans that he dealt with, he was trying to zero in on the ones that said that we needed to take a new look at the book. He was talking about Romans 8:1 with penal servitude from that standpoint. He was talking about Romans 8:17 with the two heirships. A lot of it was in place. He hadn't written anything on Romans 8:31-39, so I had understood that up until 2009 as an eternal security passage, and then, like, oh no, he's got a really good argument here. What I've been thinking here is just not right. And it's a fun thing, because God doesn't show us what the word means all at once. You bury your nose in it, you read it, you read it, you puzzle, you read it, and then things start, oh, wait a moment. Does this verse help to explain this verse in the same book, and you want to work within the same book. And the reason you want to work within the same book is different authors will use terms with different meanings, and their arguments are not always going to use the same terms in the same way. And so you want to focus on trying to understand a whole book. When you have a shorter book, you know, like for example, we've gone through Philemon, 2 John, and 3 John. They are really easy to sit down and read, and reread, and reread. And you remember when Steve Mahoney was here? We get a lot out of reading something aloud. Sometimes when you're just reading silently, you don't pick up things that you do if you're reading out loud. And listening to scripture on tape, you'd be amazed at how much text you can go through and say, wait a moment, I remember he was talking about something similar back here. And you make connections, and then you start looking at those passages. And that is a major part of the process. And it's one of the reasons that I have familiarity with passages all over the place, because you just spend time and you read, and you read, and you reread. And it's just a process. That the more time you spend with the Lord, the more He opens up the Word.
Can I ask a couple questions, John? I always understood this as, if you're walking in the Spirit, you're no longer under penal servitude. That is, you're not suffering, but that's wrong. That it's not the futility of suffering,
right?
Not suffering. You're going to suffer because we're in this world,
right?
But it's not the futility. We're actually could the potential to be rewarded by it is there,
right?
That's
okay. Yes. If we're suffering,
I didn't understand that before.
Okay. Well, let me make a crude example, and this is just off the top of my head. Let's say that. Your child does something, and they break a window. So you say, okay, you're going to have to work this off. So you put them out there splitting wood. So they're splitting wood. Do you pay them for that splitting wood? No, that's punishment. But on the other hand, if you say, you know, if you'd like to earn some spending money to be able to buy this, then you say, well, you know, you could split wood, and I'll give you some money. When it's penal servitude, there is punishment. It is not rewardable. But when the person is walking by the Spirit, which ends up with a certain amount of suffering for Christ, then it is rewardable. And so we all suffer. All of creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but in hope, in expectancy that the penal servitude would ultimately be lifted.
So he's presenting the opportunity to make something of the suffering.
Yes.
That's the whole point of the whole chapter.
Yeah, he's not talking about escaping suffering. He's talking about converting it into something else.
And then my second question is, so just like salvation, as years have gone by, every time I used to see it, I would think lake of fire, from being saved from the lake of
yep.
fire, and I understand that 70% of the time that's not the case.
It's right.
The word justification here, as soon as I see justification, I'm thinking salvation.
Sure, very good.
Can you go over that, because I'm struggling a little bit
okay,
with that.
Okay, let's go to Luke. This will illustrate. This is not in Paul, but it will illustrate. Luke chapter 18. Very familiar passage. Luke 18, starting at verse 9. And I give reference to this in the paper. Also, he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. So he stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. What a prayer. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the tax collector, standing far off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his chest, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified or vindicated, rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who exalts himself will be exalted, or humbles himself will be exalted. The term dikaiō does have a range of meaning. There are passages where it means to be vindicated.
Okay.
And I would see the Bema Seat as a place where people end up being vindicated. When God says, when Christ says, well done, good and faithful servant, that is a vindication. It's a vindication of a life well lived. And I have no problem with Paul using the term dikaiō to stand for vindication in this context. We have to remember James speaks about a justification before men. And it isn't that people say, I declare that person righteous. It's a recognition that the person is righteous, which is a vindication.
Okay, thank you.
Great.
John, is the translation from condemnation to penal servitude, is that the catalyst for this?
That's a catalyst for quite a few things, although that goes back quite a bit further. Let me help you with that. I'm glad you asked. I think that I detail it a little more here, but let's look at Romans 5. Because this word, katakrima, shows up three times in Romans. And when people have studied its use in Koine Greek, a period of time after Alexander the Great, and they looked at uses of it. Very interesting term, especially when it's in contrast with krema. So we have krema and we have katakrema. And both of those words show up in Romans 5, verse 16. Now, in this passage, what Paul is doing is comparing and contrasting what Adam did in the garden that brought death and what Jesus did to give life. So he's contrasting and comparing what Adam did, what the first Adam did, and the last Adam did. So he says, and the gift. And the gift he's talking about here is everlasting life within the context. Because look at where he talks about death entering the world through sin in this context. So the gift that he's talking about is the gift of everlasting life. But the gift is not like that which came through the one who sinned, that's Adam. For the judgment, that's krema, which came from one offense resulted in penal servitude or sentencing. But what we have is there's a judgment that is found guilty or pronounced dead. Because remember how God said in Genesis 2:17, the very day that the man and woman ate of the fruit, dying, they would die. But in Genesis 3, he doesn't pronounce them dead. You're already dead. And that's why Adam and Eve covered themselves in fig leaves. It's not one strategic fig leaf in one strategic location as all the pictures always show. They have a huge fig leaf and then try to cover a strategic spot. That is not what they were trying to do. They were trying to disappear. They were covered in fig leaves. They didn't want God to find them. They weren't worried about God seeing one part of their body. They were worried about him seeing them at all. They covered themselves in fig leaves. But God doesn't have to pronounce them the dead. They were already dead. Because remember how God said to Adam, who told you that you were naked? I mean, you wouldn't have figured this one out apart from having sinned. You wouldn't have figured that one out. You would have been naked and you never would have noticed. Because none of the animals had clothes. But they found out that they were naked because they had sinned. They were dead, alienated from God. But then the sentencing was announced in chapter 3. Judgment, dead, leads to sentencing. Thorns and thistles, sweat of your brow, and the whole works that are described there. And what, so 5:16 uses the word katakrima. It's there translated condemnation. But again, it should be sentencing or penal servitude. And it also appears in 5:18. Therefore, as through one man's offense, and judgment is in italics because it's not in the Greek text, it came to all men, resulting in katakrima. So the judgment, krima, is distinguished from the katakrima. And so they were dead, but then they had penal servitude, or the sentencing, announced. And so it also then appears in Romans 8:1. This issue had been one that I know that Zane was dealing with this at least by the 70s. I don't know when. And they were not able to give spiritual life to their offspring. That's the reason that everlasting life has to be conferred by God. They could pass on physical life, but they couldn't pass on spiritual life. And they couldn't cause anyone to rise out of penal servitude either. But now let's tie together one other thing that fits in here very nicely. The reason that we are able to receive everlasting life the moment we believe is because of propitiation. God has made it so that man does not have to be dead. Man was declared dead because of that sin in the garden. And no person has been able to transmit spiritual life to their offspring. So children are born without having life towards God. And that's the reason that God needs to confer that. But why is it that we don't need to appear at a judgment first to get life? It's because in propitiation, Jesus paid the death penalty for everyone. So people are allowed to be alive. It just is, they're dead. And so the moment we believe, we get life. Whereas you talk with people and they think, oh, we'll get it all at a great judgment in the future. No, we get life now because Jesus propitiated for the entire world. So the jigsaw puzzle piece that had not come into play until Zane wrote was he really seems to be the first person that was relating anything in 829, 830 to co-heirship. Before that, everyone just assumed it was related only to the first general heirship. But I have wished that Zane had shared his thoughts with, say, Bob Wilkin and said, this is what I think. I really would have loved that, because I'm sure Bob would have said, don't get it. And they would have had a conversation. And that, but Zane was one who did not want to complicate his writing by wrestling with how to interact with scholars until after he had written the entire presentation. He wanted his whole argument of a whole book to make sense for a final reader who might not know any Greek and so forth. And he aimed at writing at that level. And after he had completed a first draft and a second draft, then he would write notes, and then he would share his work with people that he wanted to critique him. And so there were a few times that I was able to critique his writing. I was involved in the editing of Six Secrets, for example. But nobody saw this until about a month after he died.